On a Wednesday, May 14th, this is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolf-Manera. A little pause there before the date. I liked that.
You know,
dramatic.
Just wanted to, yeah.
I was like, what day is it?
Wait.
May 14th, got it.
You do what I want to say the wrong day. I was like, let me check my little note. Just make sure I don't say.
Was it real? That was legit?
I was legit. I always write the date down because you don't want to say the wrong date. You don't want to start it off wrong.
Man, with this, I feel like pop culture is thriving with conversations like these.
Yeah,
you know?
We're trying. By the way, you know, Avi, I always talk about 90s music. I love 90s music, 90s hip hop music, 90s R&B. I mean, I feel like my era growing up, I mean, there was so much happening. Fashion-wise,
an example.
Okay, The Matrix, The Matrix.
Oh,
also,
I thought you were going to say hip hop or R&B artist.
By the way,
confusing.
Lauryn Hill.
Okay, there you go. That's what I was expecting. Yeah,
Mariah Carey.
Yeah,
all artists in the '90s. Nirvana. Okay, yeah. If you like rock. Okay,
mm-hmm, yeah.
Boy bands, big in the '90s. Okay,
a good thing.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, just asking.
Of course. Fashion was good. Uh-huh. I mean, and I'm sure there people can say whatever era you grew up in,
last century.
You probably can say that your era was the era. But lately.
Yeah, I grew up in the 1920s and I loved it. The Charleston, the Jitterbug.
You look so young. Whatever you drink, I want to drink
I've
that.
I've aged well.
But, you know, lately there have been so many reboots,
uh-huh,
right? So many remakes, so many sequels of sequels. Everything feels kind of stale.
Reductive, redundant.
Yeah, man. And you know, there was even a poll recently from YouGov that says the 2020s are the worst decade in 100 years for culture. And so we're going to talk about it. Is it really that bad? Is pop culture really dying and dead and stale? Or are folks getting old? Or is it really just not that bad at all?
Yeah.
And we have a writer from The Atlantic who's written about this, mm-hmm, in a very
deep
provocative
dive
article that explores a lot of ideas around this topic. And so our question for you, because we want to hear from you, is this the worst ever era of American pop culture? And we want to hear your argument. We want you to lay it out. Call in 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your question or comment in the chat. And I want people to tell me why you're laying this out. Like, you know, how does it compare to your era? I mean, like, what makes this one feel so different or bad? Or maybe it's not bad to you.
Well, and we should clarify. Because the writer of this story in The Atlantic, Spencer, mm-hmm, Kornhaber, tries to unpack the question of, is this the worst ever era of pop culture?
And there's a lot of reasons, yeah.
And it's not like he came up with that idea.
No.
There's a subculture of, mm-hmm, people who have become like pop culture doomers. They believe there are fundamental technological, cultural, and economic changes
that have
stifled art,
yes,
writ large, right? And so it's not just, he didn't just come up with this in his head. There's a community of people talking about this question. That's what makes it so fascinating to explore.
And it's also something that I think a lot of people have been asking themselves.
Yeah.
You know? But
every day I look in the mirror and say, is pop culture dead?
When music comes on the radio, you know, on the radio or on the streaming. So anyway.
Trio of local news stories. A troika of local news stories. A triad, if you will.
Ooh,
the first one.
Didn't fancy.
District Attorney Larry Krasner hopes to fend off challenger Patrick Duggan on May 20th. In the primary, he's trying to get a third term as Philly DA. Mm-hmm. The Inky had a story looking at where the candidates are raising the most money. Probably not too surprising, but Philly residents, Krasner has a slight money advantage raised among Philly residents.
Mm-hmm.
Krasner kind of has a national profile. He has a big edge in money from donors outside the Philadelphia region, but Duggan dominates among suburban Philadelphia donors, and he dominates so much that he's actually outraised Krasner overall 2-1. He's also got a lot of help from labor unions. So that's where the state of the money race as we head into Election Day, just 6 days away.
I know. The countdown is on. There is an election coming up, everybody. I know people.
Reminder.
Yeah, haven't been paying attention. But honestly, it's really not a surprise. you know, to me. I mean,
not a surprise.
Not a surprise. Because, well, number one, Dugin needed more money. And I knew that, because he has to battle the name recognition that Krasner has. And when the unions came out for him, I knew that that would bring him an influx of cash. But you also think about the suburbs. I mean, they're a little bit more conservative.
Yeah, that part makes sense.
You know, than the more progressive, left-leaning Philadelphians. And the other thing about the suburbs and South Jersey, I mean, they don't have a vote. So, mm-hmm. I mean, how much does their money really matter? But it does give him probably some airtime. I have been seeing ads.
Yeah.
Because he really had to introduce himself. By the way, I want to mention that WHYY had organized a district attorney candidates forum in advance of the primary. And former municipal court judge Patrick Dugin had agreed to attend. He rescinded that. And so we ended up moving forward with that event and pressed Krasner on his record, pressed him on his vision for the future, and actually pressed him on some of the reasons why Dugin has criticized him. Yeah. So that is actually going to air right here on WHYY 90.9 FM on Thursday at 9 p.m.
Appointment listening. Thank you for that. By the way, I should note that even though Dugin has raised more than Krasner, there's way less money overall in the race than there was when Krasner originally ran back in 2017. And really, I think what's most important here is that Soros, Musk, Yass, the big mega donors who could come in, mm-hmm. none of them have come in and like plunked down $1 million.
No, they didn't.
And so, yes, Dugin's got more, but it's a small money race. And I can't imagine that favors someone who's battling against an incumbent.
Yeah, incumbency is
strong.
Yeah, very strong.
Story number two, still in politics.
Yeah, Democratic National Committee Vice Chair Malcolm Kenyatta, who also happens to be a Pennsylvania State House representative, he could possibly lose his national position as vice chair due to a procedural error. Now, Kenyatta has represented North Philly since 2019. He was elected a vice chair of the DNC in February alongside 25-year-old David Hogg. Now, that name might be very familiar to you.
Know the name.
He is a gun control activist who rose to national prominence after he survived the shooting in Parkland, Florida. That probably rings a bell to you. Well, apparently, a DNC committee wants to invalidate one of the vice chair votes. They argued that the election unfairly disadvantaged women. They have a procedural rule where there needs to be some type of gender parity. It's really inside baseball. But the bottom line is that he could lose his vice chair position. And the interesting thing about this is Hogg has been very vocal nationally. He's talked about, funding
primary challengers
to Democratic incumbents.
Yeah.
And it has riled some folks who are, you know, longtime Democrats. And in a way, it put a target on his back.
Yeah.
And some say this is probably one of the reasons why they were finding a way to sort of invalidate that vote. And then
Kenyatta just kind of got taken down with
him.
That's the narrative that he's pushing, right?
Yeah.
Hogg is pushing the narrative that this is all motivated by animus toward him.
Yeah.
And the fact that he wants to shake up the mm-hmm. Democratic Party.
Kenyatta, on the other hand,
here is feeling like, wait, I have really nothing to do with this. He's been a good soldier.
Yeah, he's been working over the past 100 plus days.
Backed Biden. He's run for multiple offices. Mm-hmm. He finally sort of got to this elite status within the party. And now that's under threat. So understandably, he is pretty upset. And he feels like Hogg is making this all about him and really kind of throwing him under the bus.
And by the way,
him being Kenyatta.
Kenyatta got 298 votes to Hogg's 214. So he says, clearly I have more support than this guy.
Yeah.
So I don't know why my seat is now possibly at risk.
Kind of understand him.
Yeah.
Feels like a pretty frustrating mm-hmm. situation for Malcolm Kenyatta of North Philadelphia. Third story. We love a good provocative headline, don't we, Cherry?
We do. Lay it out.
How about this one from the New York Times? Can a $700 calendar save your marriage?
Good headline.
So the story below that talks about the rise of these very fancy, expensive digital display calendars that you hang up on your wall. One of the main calendars mentioned in this piece is called Skylight, and the founder and CEO is a Philly guy, so we figured we would just
always
use that
have a local as a connection.
Hook. But these fancy calendars are supposed to help you better coordinate your schedules as a family, and also provide a visual representation of all the mental planning that goes into family life. And that mental planning, we know from research and just anecdotes, that mental planning often disproportionately falls on women in heterosexual couples. So yeah. This is supposed to maybe help balance that out.
Yeah. And I'll say,
fancy calendars, save your marriage.
Right now, we use a Google spreadsheet for our budget, and we have a Google calendar for all of our events, and we have a family group chat for stuff like grocery lists. And guess who manages them? Moi.
Yeah.
I don't know if I pay $700 for a calendar, though.
Yeah. I mean, I laud the idea because I think the phenomenon it's trying to address is very real.
And it is real.
You start to recognize as you get older and life gets more complicated how important like the mental planning load is and how heavy that weight is. And I know that's something I've tried to work on personally.
Look it's at really, you, really Wolfman,
well.
Aaron's.
No, I don't want any plaudits for that. I really feel like it's difficult
it
because
is.
It's invisible labor. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to take invisible labor and make it visible. That said, at the end of the day, someone still has to input stuff into the calendar. And if that still
who
falls...
Who would buy that calendar? Our producer, Paige, mentioned this. Who would buy that calendar?
Yeah, right. You might just end up repeating in a louder, more visual way all the patterns you've been in. So yeah. I do think it's a heavy lift. But it's an interesting idea.
For sure.
And I'm glad that people are talking about it and trying to address it.
And another interesting idea is the idea we're going to explore about pop culture. The question of the day is this the worst era of American pop culture? We want you to lay out your arguments by calling 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org, and we'll see you on the other side of this break.
Bring back the 90s!
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Aaron. Basically, everyone above the age of 35 thinks music and movies were better back in their day. But maybe the old people today actually kind of have a point.
Maybe.
A new article in The Atlantic explores the possibility that technological and economic changes have made art blander than ever.
And we're going to talk with the author of that article for most of this hour. But before we do, we want to bring in a listener. We have Miles from Doylestown. A couple of months back, Miles actually emailed us with a show idea that sounds pretty similar to today's topic. Miles wanted to know, does music today just kind of suck? And so, Miles, we have you on Studio 2. Welcome so much. I want you to lay out your show pitch. Your question about music, pop culture, art, is it just bad? Lay it all out for us.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me. So as far as I can tell, the previous generation or the older generation that is raising children always takes issue with the newer generation and their children's generation of how they deal with the media and how they use media. Pardon me for a second.
Oh, get the dog.
What is the dog thing, Miles?
It's okay. She's okay. Thank you very much.
It's okay. Don't worry about it, man. And don't worry if the dog barks. Just go ahead and lay out the argument.
All right. Very good. Thank you. And so I asked myself, is it that I'm getting old, or is it the quality of media degrading due to the quantity of the media that's being put out there?
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm very afraid to admit the former, but it's probably the case.
Yeah. And by the way, can we just establish you're not actually that old? Like you,
I'm 37. So I fall right within the demographic of people above 35.
My exact age, by the way. So we're staring at the same sort of picture here, yeah. Miles. I am curious, was there a song or is there a genre of music, maybe movies that kind of made you start asking this question to yourself?
Ooh.
Yeah. So I was on a skiing trip with my wife and son. And on that skiing trip, I think the Grammys were on. And the music that was just walking away with all of these awards, like, not a one of them could I say was something that I would, you know, it would sneak into my brain like an earworm, and I would, like, sing it in the shower or in the car. I would probably look for a new station on the radio if it came on. Wow. And it's not because they're necessarily bad. They're just not what I was conditioned to listen to at that age or when I was younger.
And so, Miles, what was your era? Tell me what type of music that you fell in love with quickly.
Yeah, so I grew up in the 90s, and I listened to a lot of alternative rock, and then I went into, like, a more, like, easy-listening kind of genre in college that encompassed, like, U2 and some of the more sort of slowed-down melodic-type mm-hmm. music. So...
This new stuff is not sort of
a transition myself.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, we're going to leave it there.
But, yeah, Miles.
You set us up beautifully, Miles. Mm-hmm. That was Miles from Doylestown, who kind of had the idea for the show before we even knew we wanted to do it. So thanks
Miles
so much for your time. And let me introduce now our main guest for the hour, Atlantic staff writer Spencer Kornhaber. His recent article is entitled, "Is This the Worst Ever Era of American Pop Culture?" Spencer, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me. And I have to report up front that I'm also 37.
What the heck is going on today?
That's that transition
1988,
period.
Rise up!
And for those of you listening at home, in your car, and online, we want to hear from you. Is pop culture worse than ever? We want you to give us a call, lay out your argument, yes or no, why or why not. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, drop your comments in the chat.
And if you're 37, you have to disclose that information if you come on the show. Okay?
Yes. And so, Spencer, we wanted to sort of start this conversation because you cover music, you cover pop culture for The Atlantic. So what was happening? Because you invested in this article. You talked to a lot of people. You did a lot of work. What sort of drew you to this topic in the first place? What was happening such that you said, you know what, this is something we need to really talk about and dig into?
Well, as you guys have referred to, declinism is sort of an undying tradition in culture. Every generation thinks that they grew up in the golden age and everything is on the downswing since then. And so I've tried to resist that over the course of my career. I've tried to keep in mind that a lot of music critics, as they got older, started to, you know, be the old man yelling at the cloud or whatever. But I don't want to be that. But in the 2020s, you know, maybe after the pandemic, it started to feel like culture was just a lot harder to talk about. You know, I used to always kind of know what I was, quote unquote, supposed to be writing about day to day, the big stories, the big movies, albums, you know, narratives that everyone in America, or at least a large portion of America, seem to be unifying around talking about, reacting to either positively or negatively. It just became a lot harder to do over the past few years. It seemed like people were getting less excited about the new things that were coming out. And the only coherent storyline that I could hear from my peers in music criticism and other kind of arts critics fields was that story of decline. Mm. And the declinists were making very persuasive arguments that something had shifted that wasn't just, you know, the quality of music or other arts subjectively getting worse, but the structural forces that shape creative expression have shifted in a way that discourages novelty, newness, you know, quality, sustained focus, things like that.
That's the big question you have to kind of start to address as you get into this topic. Is it just taste changing? Because when tastes change, old people feel alienated from whatever the new taste is. Or is something structural changing that just makes it harder to make art? And so then you go through almost like these mini profiles of different segments of art doomers. And in the beginning of the story, you talked about this guy who's a music historian named Ted Gioia. And one of his main arguments is that music is worse because there's a financial incentive to regurgitate old music and thus, you know, because the pie is only so big, suppress new sounds and new music. That's what I took away. Can you get into his argument a little bit about why maybe there's a economic incentive to regurgitate the old right now?
Right. Well, this is talking about the idea that culture is stuck, that there's nothing new, that we're just rehashing the past. And this is a feeling that people have, experts in a lot of different fields have about the medium that they're in. You know, if you talk to people in book publishing, they talk about how their sales lists are more and more driven by old books. You know, they're trying to sell the classics rather than invest in new things. Hollywood is doubling, tripling, quadrupling down on sequels and spinoffs. Mm-hmm. And in music, it seems like a lot of the music is that gets popular is overly nostalgic. It's based on really obvious samples, or it's even old songs. You have old hits becoming popular again. If you look at the music consumption statistics in America over the past few years, you see that old music, which is defined as music older than 18 months old, comprises 75% of listening in America. So that really only leaves a quarter.
That's hard data there. That's what's so interesting about that stat. It's called catalog music, right? And more we are listening to catalog music. And is that algorithmically driven, or is that just because that's what is that? Is it because that's what's being put in front of us, or is it because that's what we want to hear?
I think it's a combination of both. You know, if you want to predict what someone is going to listen to tomorrow, you would study what they listened to yesterday. Mm-hmm. And that's what algorithms do. Mm-hmm. They analyze the tastes of their users, and they find ways to serve them up something that was either similar to what they had before or even the exact same as before. And so entertainment companies are obviously going to harness that dynamic to program and invest in things that are more similar to what came before. So that's a major driver of what's going on. And you see this happening when you have hedge funds and record labels spending hundreds of millions of dollars to buy up the publishing rights to classic artists' catalogs. Everyone from Justin Bieber to Bruce Springsteen have sold the rights to their catalogs to these financial firms, really, which then have invested interest in finding ways to remarket those old songs and create competition for that will maybe perhaps crowd out the new things.
And I'm thinking about the way music probably more organically reached users. Can you talk about how that has changed now that all of this money is involved? Because I think we kind of forget how music used to come into, you know, our ecosystem and into our own spaces.
Well, growing up in the 90s, like some of you, you know, I learned about music from listening to the radio, hearing what DJs were. I'm really excited to be programming, listening to what my friends were talking about. And then the internet came along and started digging on message boards, reading music publications, both online and in print, trying to figure out what was cool, what was new, what I could kind of define my own identity around, and also just what struck the ear as new. These days, it's a lot less of an active relationship for a lot of people. You can just open Spotify and, you know, hit play on one song and it will autoplay and serve you up other songs based on what the algorithm thinks you're going to like. And for a lot of people, that is where their music discovery begins and ends. Of course, there are ways to, you know, get out of that bubble and seek out other things. But for a lot of people, it's a much more passive experience than it used to be.
Yeah. So the counter argument then is that what was played on the radio was still controlled by a business or corporate entity. In fact, there were payola scams, some of them emanating from Philadelphia, where people were, you know, basically getting kickbacks for playing certain types of music. What was in the record store, that was also in some sense controlled by the record companies, by corporate and business interests. And when you talk about algorithms and internet discovery, there are positive examples where, like, you can hear about something and Google it or type it into YouTube and find it yourself instantaneously. You don't have to go to the record store. And in fact, you talk about an example of that in the piece. So I want to play a little bit of this song. It's by an Australian band called, I think, Glass Beams. The song is called Mahal. You mentioned it in the piece, and I looked it up for myself in 5 seconds, and I love it. So let's hear a little bit of Mahal.
Nice little rhythm there.
Isn't that great? It's like beach rock fused with kind of like an Indian sound.
Yes.
It's out of Australia.
World, sounds very world. Yeah, international. I love it.
And I was able to discover it literally sitting, you know, at my desk in 10 seconds. And so that's something the internet has allowed us to do. So is that not a counter argument to the Doomer argument about algorithms? Discovery is easier now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think there's a counter argument for all of the things that we're going to talk about, which is just that there's more freedom and there's more, it's just the world is bigger. The world of cultural creation is bigger and you really can find anything you want. And it's not just that you can find it, it's that these smaller but still very large scenes or fandoms at least kind of develop around artists that, you know, I try to keep up with music and I had never heard of Glass Beams and they had 6 million listeners to that song on Spotify when I checked. So definitely people are finding interesting things that are that maybe don't bubble up all the way to be at the top of the Hot 100. And the fact that culture is so wide now creates this perhaps impression that what's at the center are these kind of stagnant old things, because those are the only things that can build a big enough audience to rise to the top of the charts. And so if you only focus on what's popular, culture indeed looks rather stagnant. But if you widen your aperture a little bit, you can have a lot more of a hopeful vision.
Yeah. And I want to just remind people what the question of the day is. Is this the worst era or worst ever era of American pop culture? Why or why not? We want to hear your arguments. You can call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And I want to bring in a caller who we have on the line. We have Susanna from Wayne, Pennsylvania. Susanna, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Are you 37?
We want to know.
I am not. I am not 37. I am a bit older than that. This is a great topic. My comment just is that I have an almost 17-year-old who is a musician and has a lot of great friends who are really amazing musicians. Shout out to Mainline School of Rock. but they are into rock and metal and progressive rock and classic rock and all the stuff that I listened to when I was, you know, in the 80s, 90s, you know, 2000. So, you know, I'm rocking out to my, you know, to Van Halen and Creed and stuff like that with, you know, with my son. And I just think it's interesting. It blows my mind every day that, like, we're so into the same music.
Yeah.
So just wanted to put that
out there.
That's
a great comment.
Yeah,
I also
you,
just
Susanna.
Picturing you guys listening to Panama together or something like that.
It's pretty
making
cool,
me smile.
Though.
But, like, so that does come up in the piece, mm-hmm. Spencer, this idea that one of the signs of decline is that young people are listening to old stuff. Maybe dive a little deeper into that. We touched on it a bit already.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised that this is a kind of complaint that you hear from people like Ted Joya, who we mentioned. He said that in his generation, no one his age was listening to their parents' music. You know, and I guess he's talking about the 60s and 70s, where you have the rock and roll revolution, and suddenly that makes all the music from the first half of the 21st century feel just so old and fusty and like something you would never want to be associated with if you're a teenager or a young adult. Whereas now we live in a culture that the internet has kind of flattened time in some ways. And, you know, thanks to Spotify, YouTube, streaming TV, we can browse the archive with a lot more ease than mm-hmm. was previously possible. And we have a lot of competing ideas about what's cool, you know, just swirling around culture, where sometimes the trend of the week might seem to be like 70s nostalgia. Another week it'll be 90s nostalgia.
Yacht rock.
But when these things come back around, I tend to think, they usually do get reinvented in some way, that the younger generation does tend to put their own spin on it. The caller was talking about metal, and there's this hot new metal band that came out of nowhere called Sleep Token, and they're mixing hip-hop and folk and metal, and they're in the Billboard charts, and this just came out of nowhere, and to me it seemed like a sign that maybe, maybe things like sub-scenes like metal really aren't dead and actually are thriving.
Yeah, I want to read a couple comments.
Yeah,
we have
lots of
comments coming in. We have Jim from YouTube, who's on YouTube, saying, I'm a boomer and I've seen good stuff and bad stuff in every era. The people decide what's popular. And Boing on YouTube says, I didn't know how to say that. So Boing says, I feel like movies are the worst offenders in the current culture climate. But actually, some of my favorite movies also came out recently. It's just that there is so much slop. And I want to talk about that issue, because when you remove the gatekeepers, because back in the day, you know, you had to go through, you know, these music companies, you had to go through movie houses and film studios in order to get
something on your iPhone.
Now anybody can be a producer. OK, my bonus daughter is making music in her bedroom, right, with a keyboard and some software and a laptop. So when you democratize creativity and it creates this volume of things, and everybody's not listening to the same thing, does that sort of create this problem where it feels like the only thing that everybody knows about is the old stuff?
Yeah, I think you're totally right on. You know, culture is fractured. We say that there's no monoculture anymore. You know, we all used to watch, you know, not me, but people used to all watch, you know, the same late night show every night and then talk about it the next day. That's not the culture we live in anymore. It's not even the culture of 10 years ago when a show like Game of Thrones really seemed like it unified everybody in America, like talking about the latest disgusting thing that happened on TV. You know, like there's no Game of Thrones anymore. Even it feels like even the past few years, things have fractured more and more. And as we're talking about, that's created many exciting little eddies and sub scenes, but it has also kind of robbed us of a sense of cultural coherence that, I think when people talk about culture being in decline, what they're often talking about is feeling kind of disconnected from their neighbors and the world around them, because no one is watching, listening, talking about the same thing.
And I think about this because I remember standing in line after Biggie died. Okay, he was killed. I went standing in line at midnight with my friends. I asked, could I go do this? And I wanted to get the album when it came out. And it was like, you know, the CD. You stood in line. You're with strangers. It was like this community of in-person fans. And I think about that. And something feels lost now that you can just get it on your phone. And
exactly. Yeah. And what you bring up in the story, Spencer, is it's not just the community of fandom. There was also a communal aspect to creating art.
Yes.
Because you had to do it in person with other people. And Cherry brought up your bonus daughter making music by herself in her bedroom. And there is this phenomenon of like bedroom musicians. And there's someone in your piece, I think it's Jamie Brooks.
That's right.
Who talks about how that could be degrading art. The idea that music is made by and consumed by people who are physically alone. So how does that affect art?
Yeah. If you think about the history of music in particular, all of the great breakthroughs have come through people being in the same place together in a social scene.
Yep.
Things like hip hop or rock and roll, even generated out of parties, bars, you know, churches. The music was representing a social world. Nowadays, for a variety of factors, more and more of us are spending time alone, isolated, looking at our phones, not going outside. Not partying as much. You know, the statistics show that people are drinking less, going to bars and restaurants less. All of that is contributing to the kind of the demise of the scene, right? Whether that's a music scene or just a social scene or, you know, a filmmaker scene, people aren't having to test their ideas in a room with other people and have that creative back and forth quite as much as they used to, or quite in the same way that they used to. And at the same time, listeners, you know, you used to have to go to a concert hall to hear music, like not that long ago. I mean, recorded music is not that old. And even once recordings came around, you had to go to a record store to buy an album. These days, you can just consume under your covers and never speak to anyone else about the music or, So I think that is also creating this, just like, it's a bummer. It doesn't feel as good to consume music as it perhaps once did because of that loss of that social aspect. And Jamie Brooks was arguing that also on the artist side, it's creating this sort of creative stagnation where if you just sit at home working on a laptop, you're only looking at your own ideas and what you're going to generate is going to be less dynamic than someone might have generated a decade ago working in a band.
Right. It's like, where is the version of the Bronx that created hip hop, the Village that created folk, Laurel Canyon creating that California mm-hmm. sound? Like, where is that today?
Because it's an environment that, must be created. I want to read this email quickly from Heidi because I know we're about to go
to
a break.
This is a good one.
Heidi says, yes, pop culture today totally sucks. As an example, compare Joni Mitchell to Taylor Swift. Joni, sophisticated, grown up, artful in a singular, innovative way. Taylor, can anyone claim her work is any of those?
Swifties, get her! Get her!
Come for her! I rarely can find any music that's not completely derivative.
Wow.
It's unoriginal and just plain boring in the general listening arena. Ugh. That's email from Heidi. We'll talk more about this on the other side of the break.
Swifties attack!
Don't get us! Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We're talking with Spencer Kornhaber, staff writer at The Atlantic, about his newest piece. Is this the worst ever era of American pop culture? And you guys certainly have opinions about this. Kevin from Northwest Philly says, anyone complaining about the quality of pop culture in the era of Kendrick Lamar, Severance, and bootleg Eagles Super Bowl victory t-shirts is not
all right,
paying
Kevin.
Attention. A lot of you are sharing your ages now. We apparently started that. Alan, age 43, says, how many more comic book remakes and universe spinoffs do we need? And Belinda counters, age 65, TV has never before offered such high quality shows. Let's bring in another caller
now.
Should we do Brad?
Brad, let's bring in Brad from Collingswood. Brad, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, hi. Great show. It gives me an opportunity to make a comment that I just sort of been randomly throwing at people as I walk through my daily life. I'm 6 years old. In the early 70s, we had, you know, transistor radios, and we had basically, I was in the New York area at the time, we had basically three AM stations that came in well. And as a young kid, 9, 10 years old, we had three stations that came in. Two of them played sort of modern pop. The third one was like the oldie station. And my observation was that in those days, the oldie station was playing songs that were only about 15 years old, you know, from the late 50s.
They weren't that old.
Yeah, they weren't that old. But in our minds, there had been so much innovation, obviously, in, say, rock pop music in that short period of time.
That it felt old. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounded so old. Yeah. And then by the 80s, 90s, you know, AM, FM radio, if forms change, et cetera. But yeah, it's just an interesting observation at how fast musically the styles were changing at that time.
That's a great point.
And thank you. That's Brad from Collingswood.
That's
by the way, that goes to my question to you, Spencer, is this. I mean, there was an era where we were sort of shot out of a cannon. And I can't even take credit for this because there was a New York Times article where they talked about this a couple of years ago. There was this era in the late half of the 20th century where, you know, we went from, you know, vinyl to 8-track to cassette tape CD to MP3 to iPod. Now we're on streaming, where we just had this shot out of a cannon culture shift. And now the dust has sort of settled into this streaming space. And that's why we're just used to going much faster. Is the speed of change just sort of slowed down right now? And it feels like it's stagnant. But in actuality, this was just normal because we just grew up in an era where things were shifting, kind of like what our last caller was saying.
That might be part of it. But I also don't think that change has really slowed down that much if you pull back and think about it. I mean, something like TikTok came along only like 5 or 6 years ago, and I think has completely changed culture and rewired a lot of our brains. And that's changed what goes on streaming. And so, you know, maybe TikTok is about to start feeling old, and I worry that something even more addictive is about to come along.
Let me read in this comment from someone on YouTube, Ormead Press, who says, I find I am now listening to music by bands from foreign countries, the UK, Australia, Ireland, etc. Same thing with movies and television. I love foreign shows and movies. U.S. content seems boring.
Oh, blames it on the U.S.
But there still is this idea of being able to globalize your taste and your attention, which was not possible maybe 50 years ago, or much harder to do. Let's bring in another caller now. This is Joan from Philadelphia on line one. Says she is not 37. What a shame. Joan, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, this is Joan Flannery, Neil's mom from Tacoma Park.
Hey!
Because I'm originally from here.
That's
awesome. I'm a radio person. I grew up with Wibbage and Jerry Blavitt and then WXPN and, you know, even with, and your station with Ed Gottlieb. That wasn't music, but Terry Gross. So I'm a radio person. I'm always listening to radio. I'm always trying to hear you. So I will say that I would generally say creativity in general. I'm an artist and an art teacher, and I would say I still am teaching a couple classes at 70. And I will say the creativity of the young people in that way has been overly influenced by graphic images, and they're asking for erasers at early ages, and they don't, it's not as creative as it used to be. But I would say the music has wide open because of TikTok, because of the internet. I'm listening to all kinds of stuff. You know, I think Playing for Change is awesome. You can hear people from all over the world. I'm listening to Gimme Shelter right now, which was a Stones thing, and I was never a big Stones fan, but Squirrel Nut Zippers, which is sort of like I don't know if you know who they are, but they are sort of like big bands, but with a modern swing, and like Leon Bridges. I mean, I still listen to a lot of different kinds of music, and when I'm watching a film or even in the car listening to one of these radio things, I will hear something and I'll Shazam it and like look it up later.
That's how I do it.
I want to hear new music.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other thing that you can find.
Yeah.
And I do think the quality of music in films is better. Like you'll see these composers. I can't tell you off the top of my head, but I have definitely looked them up. And so I think music is definitely, you know, exploded. And I do think that I'm not a huge Swiftie, but my friends are. And when I look at her content, what she's talking about is incredible.
Yeah.
And I do think that Brandi Carlile is really, I mean,
there's a lot of good people.
Joan, first of all, so nice to talk to you. I grew up with Joan's son in Maryland, and so nice to hear
you
on the air. And thanks for your call. And there's someone with a much more positive take on what's going on right now. Spencer, what did you take away from that call? I like the Shazam observation.
I love
change
Shazam.
Things a little bit.
Yeah.
Spencer, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I was interested that she was citing artists from all over the time spectrum, right? This is part of what we're talking about. You can be really into Squirrel Nut Zippers from, you know, however many decades ago they were, and you could be really into Taylor Swift now, and that feels sort of new, and maybe is creating some of this sort of cultural confusion that we're talking about. So I agree that someone like Taylor Swift is, you know, you may not think that she is as good as Joni Mitchell. Sure. You can probably find people who you might feel fit the Joni Mitchell mold a little better if you dig for them. But what Taylor Swift is doing is creating a form of pop music that is just so much more specific and nuanced and literary and personal than any pop star of her size had ever pulled off before. And it's inspiring a generation of young singers, especially young women like Chapel Roan or Olivia Rodrigo, to make really, really interesting pop music that I think is a real bright spot right now. And we may look back at this moment and say it was actually a golden age for kind of singer-songwriter pop.
And by the way, Julie on YouTube says there are some really obvious examples of amazing music today. And she mentions Olivia Rodrigo,
Chapel Roan. Yeah.
She says amazing artist, but quality over quantity. I want to sort of go down this positive route because you mentioned TikTok has changed the game. We have SoundCloud. People are able to produce more. And I actually, I went to see a movie called Sinners. One of the best films I have seen in a long time. And I see a lot of films. I mean, are there things that are sort of influencing culture that are bringing people together, even though the bar is a little higher?
Yeah, I think for sure. I think that the good things right now are really good and really interesting and forward thinking. In a lot of cases, the way to move culture forward is to think about the obstacles that exist to stop creativity, the very things that we're talking about in this conversation, things like isolation and stagnation, this feeling like there's too much. A lot of the most interesting movies lately that have come out, I feel like are kind of addressing those things by being really fast-paced and creatively edited and just, you know, they keep you on the edge of your seat and play with your attention in a way that feels very now. I'm thinking about movies like, you know, everyone talks about Barbie, but also a movie like Oppenheimer, which came out the same summer, totally different kind of movie, is edited in this way that I feel like was only possible once we'd all adjusted our brains to TikTok rhythm. And Chris Nolan was able to tell this story by montaging a lot of these really tight short scenes to tell this epic interconnected historical drama. So things like that give me a lot of hope. There's a lot of music that's coming out right now that's really fast-paced and personal and upbeat and futuristic and distorted and challenging that I don't think you could have heard in another era.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I want to read in a few more comments.
So many.
Jamie from Upper Darby says, I think on the contrary, we're in the best era of pop culture because when you remove the apparatus of mass adoption of art and music, you end up with the opportunity for smaller, more genuine works of art to be heard more widely. Jeff, and this gets to something else. Jeff says, streaming services are to blame for mediocre, bland formula, repetitive, predictable, melodramatic acting, over-the-top, political correctness TV series that would have never seen the light of day had it not been for streaming services. Putting the streaming thing aside, there is part of this piece that talks about the way the culture wars have infected culture. And there's a great quote in here that culture, I believe this is what you wrote, Spencer, culture has come to feel more and more like an embittered sports rivalry, and that things get elevated because they represent one side or the other,
the politics,
not because they're actually genuinely great art. And you profile an art critic in the piece, Dean Kissick, who makes that argument. That's the one to me that felt like the most prisoner of the moment, to be honest, because I feel like that's the thing that comes and goes. But make the case and maybe the counter argument that the culture wars have ruined maybe culture in general.
Yeah, I mean, you know, art has always been political, and I don't want to act like it hasn't been. You know, but in the past 10 or so years, we all know that we've lived through the quote unquote Great Awakening, where issues of identity, gender, and political messaging is just much closer to the center of the cultural conversation than it was for a long time. And a lot of that has been great and well-intentioned and produced some really interesting stuff, but it's created also backlash. And more than that, it's created the sense of, tension in culture and the sense that a lot of people don't trust what they're seeing in the way that they used to. There's always this feeling like you might be kind of watching a piece of propaganda rather than a work of entertainment or art. And so I think a lot of people have stepped back from culture or look at mainstream cultural products with a new kind of cynicism because we're living in this highly politicized era. You know, a good portion of the country doesn't trust Disney anymore because they've, invested in representational or more diverse forms of storytelling. And that's turned off a lot of people. And now Disney is kind of like used to be for everyone. And a good portion of the country says, I'm actually going to skip the next Disney movie.
Yeah.
Wow. But will that self-correct? Because one of the issues is, you know, there are waves of interest, right? There are periods of time where you're more interested in women movies or having people of color or, you know, this type of person. Could that just self-correct as time passes?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope the country all comes together and we have a, you know, one big happy movie night. Yeah.
Movie night.
Can I just say real quick, as we start to wrap up, a lot of people in our comments are talking about AI. Mm-hmm. And as I read your piece, I was actually surprised how AI was not centered, because that's what I sort of expected. Like, AI has corrupted creativity, or it's enhanced creativity, or something like that. You talk about AI, but it's really not like the main character in this piece, at least in my opinion. So before we wrap up entirely, where do you see AI in this entire conversation?
Yeah, I think we're really at the beginning of the AI storyline. And, you know, yeah, I mean, very quickly, this piece might seem out of date because culture's changing again. But, you know, you got to write for the times that you live in. And I am certainly concerned that it seems like younger people are going to outsource their writing abilities to ChatGPT. It seems like a lot of the constraints that artists face that created like very interesting outcomes will be gone due to AI. And the thing that I really worry about is the overabundance of so-called slop. You know, streaming services are going to be filled with imitative works that you don't really have to pay an artist royalties for. And so something like Spotify might start elevating AI-generated music over the music of made by people, and that will just further discourage creativity. So things like that sort of freak me out. But I also am very open to the idea that AI tools will help artists just create things that they never could have created before and show us things that we could have never imagined. I think that's also going to happen.
Yeah. And so as we wrap up, we got to ask you the question. Do you think we are living in the worst ever pop era culture? Do you think this is the worst ever era for pop culture?
No, I don't. I think the 1810s were probably worse. I don't know what's happening. Let's just throw them under the bus. No, I mean, I feel like there's the things that are happening now are really interesting and exciting. And when I dial in, I feel really good about being alive right now. But I'm also, there's this, just this feeling of dread and malaise that is coming from other parts of the world that isn't culture. It's coming from the economy. It's coming from politics. It's coming from technological change. And culture maybe isn't keeping up in quite the same way, or we're not able to connect with culture in the way that feels familiar. And so a lot of people feel alienated from this moment. And I wrote this piece to understand why. And I think there's good reason to feel alienated, but you can do something about that. You can get outside of your bubbles and you can find the really good stuff. And hopefully the more people that do that, it will just encourage more quality.
Well,
thank you so much for this piece and for joining us this hour, Spencer Kornhaber, staff writer at The Atlantic. Everyone should check out that piece about whether or not we are living in the worst ever era of pop culture. Spencer, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, guys.
And can I just end with an email that actually gets to both sides of this? Jordan says, I think pop culture in the traditional sense is incredibly stale, most notably in film. The independent era of culture is here, where the internet allows people to find their smaller circles that tailor to their tastes. There are so many extremely talented people out there. A little give and take in that comment.
I love that. And I love Spencer's marching orders. Get out of your bubble.
That's
and
true.
Look for some culture. So thank you so much to our producers. Debbie
don't
Builder.
Leave the Studio 2 bubble, please.
No, please. Matter of fact, bring a friend to the bubble. We need more people in the bubble. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Kalake engineered today's show. And our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philly. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll try to not pop that bubble tomorrow.